Tonight, I had thought I wanted to talk about what the Quakers call speaking truth to power. How we use speech in our relationships and in the world. And then I thought, no, I want to back up a step and talk about sort of what prior to speaking and acting kind of motivates us. And I wanted to talk about conscience. You know, what is conscience? In our Buddhist practice, how does it work? What is it? It seems like these days in our society and in our world that conscience is being degraded on a daily basis. In the public sphere, wrongdoing is routinely covered up, denied, or spin-doctored beyond recognition. In fact, being a spin-doctor is a very lucrative profession in our culture. I've just spent a week and a half south of the border in the States. And so this is very present for me. I had to, as part of my practice, was listening to the people around me express their distress about the election campaign. So it seems sometimes even harder to speak truth to power than it was several decades ago when the phrase was often used. And then in the private realm, we have available to us myriad virtual fantasy worlds where people can play out violent, aggressive, or sexual behaviors without having to consider the consequences. You know, in the virtual realm. Even in everyday life, petty theft, lying, abusive language, all seem to have ratcheted up several notches from the world I grew up in. Does anybody else feel that way, even though most of you are younger than me? Yeah? Still feels that way, doesn't it? You know? So how is anyone supposed to know what to believe and how to act conscientiously in this world? I actually did a day-long workshop format with my teacher, shared it with my teacher Norman Fisher almost 10 years ago. And so I went back and looked at some of what I said then, and I'm going to recycle it for you because it seems even more present now. Some of the questions we talked about were, what is conscience? How does it develop in us? What is a fully mature sense of conscience? What is absence of conscience? How are good people persuaded to act in unconscionable ways? Right? We've seen it happen. Or we've heard about it. How can we resist such persuasion? What does it take to live a life of conscience? And what role does courage play? So, before I go any further, I'd like to invite you to do a little personal reflection on conscience, okay? So if you would, I just invite you to join me in this. So you might want to just close your eyes and sit in your meditation posture for a minute to help get centered. And just cast your memory back to a time when you were a child. Just close your eyes and see what comes up. And see if you can remember the first or at least a very early time when you felt conscience stricken. Often we remember some of our very earliest experiences of feeling conscience stricken. You could call it a guilty conscience, or just, you know, that feeling of I've done wrong. What were the circumstances? And how did you feel in your heart, in your body? And at that time, where did that sense of conscience, that sense of I've done wrong, where did that come from? You may come up with a specific incident, or it may be more just a feeling. You know, just notice what arises. And then letting go of that time, traveling forward in time, and try and recall a more recent instance of feeling your sense of conscience at work in you. It may have been something you did or something that you held back from doing, but your conscience was at work. Again, what were the circumstances? How did you feel in your heart, in your body? And then notice any difference between your adult experience and your childhood experience. Where that sense of conscience comes from, or how does it arise? Okay, and then letting go of that memory, that time, and we'll touch back on these, but coming back to the present. And thank you for trying that. And it may be that it needs more time for reflection later, if something important came up for you. So what is conscience? A dictionary definition is the sense of what is right or wrong in one's conduct or motives, impelling one toward right action. And we could add restraining one from harmful action, right? So note that it's not only our conduct but our motives that are subject to the force of conscience. If we act in a way that's superficially virtuous, right? But our motives are contaminated by self-interest, you know, by wanting to look good or wanting approval or greed or aversion, fear. Our conscience pricks us. Our conscience knows that our motives are mixed. But this dictionary definition doesn't specify the basis for conscience. So I'm going to read you another definition that goes further. And this is from Martha Stout, who is a psychologist and a researcher, who wrote a book called The Sociopath Next Door. And as you probably know, sociopaths or psychopaths or people who we label as antisocial have a severe conscience deficit. So she says, conscience is a sense of obligation ultimately based in an emotional attachment to another living creature, often but not always a human being, or to a group of human beings, or even in some cases to humanity as a whole. Conscience does not exist without an emotional bond to someone or something, and in this way, it is closely allied with the spectrum of emotions we call love. This alliance is what gives true conscience its resilience and its astonishing authority over those who have it, and probably also its confusing and frustrating quality. So it's based on care, you know, a connection, a relationship of care. Not everyone might agree with that, but that's her definition. Now, in case anyone's wondering, well, isn't Buddhism about non-attachment? I want to affirm that non-attachment does not mean cold detachment. It means not being attached to our own self-centered agendas, our own fixed views, that constantly place barriers between ourselves and others. It's profoundly important that the Buddhist concept of emptiness not be confused with a kind of amoral, conscienceless way of being in the world. Just as we have to have a functioning sense of self in order to go beyond the small self, we have to have a functioning sense of attachment, connection, call it connection, and human relationship to go beyond that narrow sphere of self-interest or self-centered attachment. So conscience is about relationship, interconnectedness, and it develops in relationship. Some of the psychologists who first studied moral or ethical development in children observed that very young children learn to govern their behavior based on rules given by adults and punishment meted out by adults. So according to those developmental psychologists, children at that stage, that first stage, see rules as absolute, right? Received from parents. Externally imposed. And then they gradually progress to an internalized sense of morality, conforming to social expectations or religious expectations, external authorities, and then develop further as adults into a sense of mature morality, which by no means everyone attains, in which the individual is able to align their conscience with moral principles of their own choosing. Well, that's a very rational kind of view and very cognitive. And yet other researchers have observed that even very young children sometimes act with surprising empathy towards others, and have a seemingly precocious sense of what actions are harmful and unfair. Even little children can have a sense of fairness. Do you remember? Yeah, it's not fair. How many of us said that? And also of caring. If children have received care, they can extend care to others, sometimes surprisingly young. So it may be that we are in fact much more hardwired for empathy and caring than has been recognized in cognitive science. And more recent research suggests how crucial relationship and the resonance of mutual caring is to the development of our capacity for emotional awareness, for empathy. You know, we flinch at the sight of someone being struck, even if it's on TV, because our bodies resonate with other bodies, other beings. And we feel our distress and remorse in our bodies when we have harmed another, right? So it's very deeply part of us. But what happens when a person does not develop conscience? And it's not really understood well how that happens, how that comes about. But there are people who have serious deficits in that area and can do a great deal of harm. Martha Stout, who I just mentioned, identifies the lack of conscience as the key identifying characteristic of a sociopath or psychopath. It's an impaired ability to love or empathize with others. And apparently, PET scans, PET scans of brain scans of sociopathic individuals have shown neurodevelopmental deficits in processing emotional stimuli. You know, reading emotional expressions in others. So their brains struggle to process emotional information, maybe in the way mine might struggle to process a higher math problem. Stout estimates that a stunning 4% of the U.S. population are sociopaths. They may be in prisons, corporations, politics, and they might be your next door neighbor or colleague at work. Some are violent or engage in criminal behavior, but others are chronically manipulative and callous in human relationships, leaving a trail of shattered lives behind them. Perhaps we've all met someone who kind of meets that description. Do you remember a documentary called The Corporation by Joel Bakan of UBC, I believe? He made a very strong case that contemporary mega corporations can be diagnosed as sociopathic. In their values and in their behaviors. But most of us are not sociopaths. Most of us have a reasonably functional sense of conscience, right? But probably all of us can think of times when we've not had the courage to do or say what we thought was right. What blinds or impairs conscience in relatively normal individuals? How is it that so many children of Nazi death camp guards said, "Oh, but he was a loving father"? Yeah. How is it that so many of us bow down to corporate agendas that threaten the very earth systems on which our lives depend? Martha Stout points first to our relationship to power and authority, especially when it's coated with kind of glamour and charisma. How we're conditioned to respect and defer to authority and to doubt our own perceptions. She also points to that human tendency to what's called moral exclusion. Moral exclusion is when we see a person or a group of people or species, for that matter, as other, as outside our moral sphere of care. and consideration. So we can treat others outside our sphere in ways that we would never treat a member of our tribe without being conscience-stricken. We can set our scruples aside. We can silence our objections, sometimes out of fear of reprisal from our social peers or our superiors. Human fear of rejection by the group is very strong, right? You know, fear of rejection by family, by work colleagues, by friends. How many of us have the depth of courage and conscience to truly bear the burdens of our actions? How can we be vigilant in ourselves that we not collude with conscienceless agendas, political, corporate, or social? If we look at human behavior throughout history, it seems pretty self-evident to me that restraining harmful behavior out of based on fear is ultimately not very effective. You know, whether we're afraid of the wrath of God or karmic retribution or parental or social rejection, those fears are all too easily overridden by desire, hatred, delusion, the three poisons in Buddhism, greed, hatred, and delusion, can override, you know, the restraining effects of those threats. So it seems to me that it takes something more than fear-based restraint to make a genuine sense of conscience. And that ingredient is connection, compassion, relationship, non-separation. And we could do no better than to start by being aware of our own body and mind. Philip Zimbardo is a researcher who became famous, or maybe notorious, for an experiment at Stanford University in the 1960s. Did you ever hear of the Stanford Prison Experiment? Yeah. Subjects, they were ordinary university students, were divided into prisoners and guards and put in a simulated prison environment. There's actually been a movie made about it that I haven't seen yet. It's on Netflix, I noticed.
Yeah. I haven't seen it either, but
yeah, so we might want to check it out. The experiment was supposed to have lasted 2 weeks, but it was called off after 6 days because the guards had become so cruel and sadistic, and the prisoners increasingly passive, that they had to stop the experiment. It became a turning point in terms of the ethics of research, and it haunted Zimbardo for decades. Ever since 9/11, he's been concerned with the general degree of fear and intimidation in the American public, who fear to speak out. So he's turned his attention to how ordinary citizens can build resistance and resilience in the face of mass media brainwashing and public pressure. He wrote a book called The Lucifer Effect. Lucifer being another name for the devil. He's talking about evil. I'm not fond of the word evil, but it's that capacity that we all have to do harm, to be, from greed, hatred, and delusion. We all have that capacity to do harm. And what he proposes is that if evil is indeed banal, if ordinary people can do horrible things under certain circumstances, then perhaps heroism is likewise ordinary, and we can actually cultivate the resilience and the courage to resist evil. Or we could say greed, hatred, and delusion. And significantly, he has a 10-step program, and mindfulness is the second step. Simply being aware of body and mind is the second step, second only to the ability to recognize and admit one's own mistakes. That's at the top. The humility and self-awareness to be able to admit one's own mistakes. Next, mindfulness. And then the third is taking responsibility for one's decisions and actions. I actually have his 10 steps, and I'm going to post them on our website if people want to go on. I'll send out the link. It'll be under password protected materials because, you know, this is copyrighted and I don't want to post it on the website itself. So the password is, you can all know it, Prajna Paramita. I'll put it, I'll spell it later. I'll put it in the newsletter. Anyway, you might want to look at these in more detail because they're pretty interesting. And it's interesting in that these very capacities that he's recommending are totally congruent and overlapping with the practices that we do here and that the Buddha taught. But, you know, doesn't all this require more courage than most of us can possibly muster? You know, it's easy to think of those whose moral courage we admire, the Dalai Lama, Nelson Mandela, Aung San Suu Kyi, Thich Nhat Hanh, and find ourselves sadly wanting, right? How can we live up to that bodhisattva ideal, that impossible bodhisattva ideal? And yet, seemingly ordinary people do extraordinary acts of courage. Who do extraordinary acts of courage often say they don't see themselves as particularly courageous. They just did what had to be done. They simply responded to another's suffering. They felt as though there was no other choice. I read a book some years back called Conscience and Courage, Rescuers of Jews During the Holocaust by Eva Fogelman. She did a 10-year study and she interviewed over 300 people who had rescued Jews during the Holocaust. Many did not think of themselves as courageous heroes. Some of the traits that she found they had in common were a combination of personality and situational factors. Situational factors were being presented with the opportunity to help, social support for the action, economic resources, the nature of their living quarters, the characteristics of the person who needed help. And the top personality factors were keen self-awareness, a questioning mind that would allow them to see through Nazi propaganda, and trust in their own deepest knowledge. And a feeling of responsibility or conscience that would not allow them to turn away from suffering. Tenacity, determination, a sense of personal competency, those were all so important. But many, many of them felt fear almost constantly. You know, they were in wartime situations, in great amount of stress, so they weren't free of fear. Courage was certainly not an absence of fear for them. And their motivations varied too. Some were motivated by a strong feeling of moral conscience, might be religious or ideological, or simply compassionate. And some were motivated by their affinity with particular Jewish people they knew, or with the Jews as a people. Some were motivated by their commitment, by their anti-Nazi resistance. And some by a sense of strong professional ethics. Maybe they were a doctor or a social worker. So it varied. But in every one, there was a sense of human kinship. And to core values that were able to override that fear of punishment or fear of retaliation. So there's no one size fits all, and conscience is complex, right? But the gift of having a conscience is our ability to love, to truly respond to others. Martha Stout says, I really like this, she says, in small and large ways, genuine conscience changes the world. Rooted in emotional connectedness, it teaches peace, opposes hatred, and saves children. It keeps marriages together and cleans up rivers and feeds dogs and gives gentle replies. It makes individual lives better and increases human dignity overall. By the time I finished her book, I thought she was probably a closet Buddhist. That's all I'm going to say for now. And what I'd like you to do is take a few moments to talk to each other about this, and I'll tell